you. Would you please reach behind you for the Bible that's in the doodah behind you? I've asked the ever versatile Tim to come and preach. I've sprung this to read the passage, Genesis 37. I don't know what page. Tim, come on up. We're starting a new series in Genesis, looking at Joseph's life and family. So Genesis 37. Tim's going to read the first 11 verses.
Jacob lived in the land where his father had stayed, the land of Canaan. This is the account of Jacob's family line. Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And he brought their father a bad report about them. Now, Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons, because he had been born to him in his old age, and he made a richly ornamented robe for him. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of corn out in the field, when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright, while your sheaves gathered round mine and bowed down to it." His brothers said to him, "Do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us?" And they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he had said. Then he had another dream. And he told it to his brothers. "Listen," he said, "I had another dream. And this time the sun and moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." When he told his father as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream you had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you?" His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind.
Well, thank you, Tim, for making, and this is really what I wanted, for making Joseph sound really irritating. Imagine we're on a film set. I've often thought I'd love to have been a film director. At this point, the director would say, "Cut. I cannot believe that the script says this. This is supposed to be a movie about one of the great heroes of the faith. It's so unlikely that he would behave like this. It's such an unpromising start. This is terrible material. Who wrote this stuff?" And you couldn't really blame the director, could you? This is a really messy start to the family saga that we start today. So for the next few weeks, we're going to be looking at the life and times of Joseph, Genesis 37 to Genesis 50. And if you can each week read ahead a little bit, that would be great. It would really help your understanding of what's going on. When we think of Joseph, I think we probably have a fairly fixed image. Here's an unhelpful one for the 50-year-old teenagers amongst us. This is the goat of many colors. Get it? So what's the account of Joseph? What's the story of Joseph really all about? I think as we go through the book, we could agree that that what Joseph and his brothers got up to offers a real picture of what it is to be human. Betrayal, triumph, jealousy, sexual temptation, favoritism, just seen that, it's all there. And at the center of the story is a very unpromising teenager who actually becomes the top man in Egypt. Really, the vizier is one expression that's used, the prime minister. At a time, in fact, when Jews were very much at the heart of Egyptian politics. Enough of that. But I don't want us to think over the next few weeks that all we have to do is to listen carefully to what Joseph did or didn't do, or what his brothers did or didn't do, and graft a few lessons onto our own lives. There will be some observations we can make, but this is not a biography of Joseph for its own sake. and it's not an opportunity for random life lessons that we can pin to the fridge door. That's never the case in Scripture. The bigger point in Scripture is always this: God is on the move. What is He doing? And how is He involving people and situations in His plans? You probably know the expression feet of clay. It may originally come from the description of a huge statue in Daniel chapter 2. Its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of baked clay. As an expression, it's come to mean that all of us, when everything's said and done, have fundamental flaws. No one in human history, however great their stature or their accomplishments, has ever managed or will ever manage to break free of the fact that we're all fundamentally flawed and have feet of clay. And yet, Scripture tells us that despite all our flaws, despite our human condition, if you like, we are more loved by God than we could ever imagine. Let me ask a question. It's a rhetorical one, really, because it's as much aimed at myself as anything else. Do you really believe that to be true, that we're more loved by God than we could ever imagine? I struggle to accept that because I know what I'm like. But right the way through Scripture, wherever you look, time after time, God lavishes His love on people who have feet of clay. So, God is on the move at all times. Joseph's family story is the story of people with feet of clay. God loved them anyway, and He was working out His plans through them. Another way of looking at Joseph's family life over the next few weeks would be to say that God is starting a family which will give great blessing. And these are the accounts of the patriarchs, so the forefathers of Jesus' own family line. And it's no exaggeration today that you and I are here today because of what God did through these people. This is our own spiritual ancestry, and these are our own spiritual roots. But if we look at what happened to Joseph, we see that the raw materials, who God chooses to work through, can be very unpromising. If proof was ever needed, the things that Joseph had to put up with show that dysfunctional people like us, are never a barrier to God's plans. And speaking for myself, it's been a massive relief to understand that as I've prepared for this. You and I can be agents of God's plans in our current sorry state. You only have to look at what Joseph's brothers did to him to see that. Who was that, by the way? Yes, the Bash Street kids. Reuben, for example, slept with his father's mistress. In chapter 34, two of Jacob's sons behaved like war criminals by attacking a city and killing every male. In chapter 35, they indulge in a bit of idol worship. These were hard men. These were thugs, if you like. And towards Joseph, as we'll see, they behave particularly badly, throwing him down a cistern, a well, when jealousy got the better of them. And their attitude, of course, towards him wasn't helped by the fact that he was Jacob's declared favorite, or by the fact that he made the claims that Tim's just read to us. Joseph tells his brothers, essentially, that in due course, unlikely though it sounds, they would in due course bow down to him in worship. Not a smart move, you might think, for the youngest brother. Virtually guarantees the last of the bathwater, no pudding, and a beating after Mum has turned the lights out. So far, then, nothing admirable. But we'll see over the next few weeks that this is the family that God has chosen, amazing though that may seem. And as one commentator puts it, once you look carefully at the people of God, you start to understand the grace of God. Once you look carefully at the people of God, you start to understand the grace of God. How many times is that repeated in Scripture? David, Samson, Saul, Peter, any of the disciples. On we go. Feet of clay, every single one of them. And there's never been a period in Scripture when it's been possible to say, ah, now God can really start to get to work. Look at the quality of these people. So once you look carefully at the people of God, you start to understand the grace of God. The second point we might extract over the next few weeks from the Joseph story as a whole is this. Once we appreciate the silence of God, we can start to appreciate or understand the mystery of God. Once we appreciate the silence of God, we begin to appreciate the mystery of God. We might want to call this taking the long view. And it's been a relief for me to understand this as well, taking the long view. Let me explain. So the week before last, we came back from Australia. We'd been visiting Pip's parents in Sydney. And on the plane, I negotiated the window seat with Ella. He was very gracious about it, provided I could have the window seat on the second leg. I'm afraid, as the next photo demonstrates, 21 hours on the plane eventually took its toll. That's me with one of those head cushions on. Anyway, on the flight, I watched the huge Australian desert unfold. We can get rid of that one, Richard, if that's all right. It rolled underneath the plane for almost 3 solid hours, the Australian desert. I couldn't speed it up. All I could do was watch it in all its vastness roll underneath the plane. I didn't take this, but that's the Australian desert. But we live in an age where everything is super fast. So, for example, as soon as we landed, my phone coughed into life and there was 24 hours worth of emails. I was back on solid ground and I could, if I wanted, order anything to my door within hours, if not minutes. If someone sends me an email at work, they will expect a response the same day. And if I don't send one, I'll get a chaser. If my children put something on Instagram, they expect immediate likes and responses. And for us oldies, there's Facebook, and we expect likes and shares instantly. Question, rapid answer. Demand, rapid supply. And I read recently about 2 businessmen complaining about the sheer speed at which business is conducted. Turned out they were talking to each other in 1860. So what we've become used to today would be way outside their understanding. And I appreciate that it's a feature of getting older to complain about how fast things appear to have become. But I certainly have the impression that our capacity to wait for things has been severely compromised. We're almost completely anesthetized against taking the long view. And the speed of the age means that we've come to apply those standards just as much to how we view God's work. Because I want spiritual results to arrive straight away with my Amazon parcel. I'm impatient, I get disappointed, I lose heart very quickly. And if things appear to work against me, I get very bitter. But to appreciate what God is doing, we need to cultivate the long view and a sense of God's mystery. Let me say that I think the word mystery is not a dirty phrase. We don't leave much room for God's mystery, particularly in the UK church, where we, I think, have this sense that we can understand, broadly speaking, what God is about to do at any time. But look at Isaiah 55, verse 8. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. As Joseph discovered later on when he was able to reflect on events, God is at work even if we don't see his actions or sense his presence. And it's really striking, if you could take that one down, Richard, thanks. It's really striking that God is not mentioned once in chapter 37. God is not mentioned once in chapter 37. And at no time does he step in, even when Joseph is being stripped of his robe and left for dead in a well later on. So if anyone could make the case for being abandoned by God, it's Joseph. And like anyone who's living through an experience rather than reading about it afterwards, Joseph didn't know how it was going to end. And although he could have done, God didn't step in earlier when Joseph was making himself vulnerable by saying boastful things to his brothers. And if Joseph's life was a Hollywood film, there might be an older, wiser person that just sneaks in on the side and says gently in his ear, you might want to just tone that bit down. But in this chunk of Genesis, everyone seems to be doing their own thing. The absence of God seems to be a theme of chapter 37. And speaking for myself, this is familiar territory. God has abandoned me. He doesn't care about me or about my family member or about my situation or that situation over there. I don't sense God's presence. Don't you see or hear or care? And crises come and go and they destabilize us and we forget to consult God and we press on with our own agenda. I'm an absolute master at pressing on with my own agenda as a default position when I can't hear from God. Loved by God, but I ignore him. But once we appreciate the silence of God, we can begin to appreciate the mystery of God. The Joseph story is told in enormous detail to blow away the idea that God simply abandons us. A few decades ago, a man called Derek Kidner wrote this about Joseph's life. Everything from the ill-conceived demands to the chance meeting with the stranger to the delivery into the brother's hands, God was as watchful here as in any miracle. So we'll see as we look at Joseph's life in the next few weeks that in fact God was as watchful when Joseph was boasting to his brothers or when he was thrown down the well as he had ever been. And we need to get hold of this in the hard times and the baffling times when the silences are real and painful. But it doesn't mean that God has abandoned you. Rescue came to Joseph and God's plan was not thwarted. And here's the big point. God's plans are never thwarted. God's plans are shatterproof. And hard times will come to all of us. It's guaranteed. But it's right in the middle of those hard times when we need to cling on, when I need to cling on to the fact that God is working out his plans despite signs to the contrary. And it's okay to say, I just don't know what God is up to. That's not failure, quite the reverse. We can't see things from beginning to end, but God, of course, can. So lastly, to finish, once you've seen the hand of God, once you've seen the hand of God, you can begin to speak the praise of God. You have to look for God's hand in chapter 37. And it sometimes, often in fact, takes time and patience to be able to see God at work and to turn what he's doing into praise. I can virtually promise you that Joseph would not have seen it that way as he lay in the bottom of his pit later in chapter 37. So your situation and my situation may not begin to resemble Joseph's in any physical sense. We're sitting here today in church, not at the bottom of a pit. But as a metaphor, as a picture, it's hard to beat. Languishing at the bottom of the pit, betrayed, wondering what on earth happens next, and especially where is God in all this? Now, it's at that point, isn't it, that bitterness and resentment can take a hold of you. But if we can train ourselves to look at the broad canvas, the long view, and say, in due course, I now see that was part of the kindness of God, then we can start to say the praise of God. And it's probably fair to say that Joseph was someone for whom these words in Romans 8:28 could have been written. And we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. God is always kind. God is never capricious. And losing faith is always a choice. So what was the kindness that Joseph could look for? He was thrown into a pit, but he wasn't murdered. And that sounds very easy for me to say. But there's an element of truth in that. Thrown into a pit, but not murdered. And it was empty. He didn't drown in the pit, in the cistern. So as pits go, it wasn't a bad one to be thrown into. And his brother Judah sells him on, so in a sense there was salvation. These were acts of God's sparing kindness, and those have been passed down to us. His life was preserved. Sometimes we can see the small kindnesses of God, and from deep within us we can start to say, I will praise your name. Hard though that sometimes is. Because whatever it feels like, God is in charge and in control, and his plans are shatterproof. So in the next few weeks, 5 or so weeks, let's watch carefully to see God's plans taking shape and being fulfilled in spite of, not because of, in spite of Joseph's dysfunctional family and situation. Let's look carefully for signs that God is at work, despite the sometimes shattering silence. And let's say, on our own and together, I trust you in spite of circumstances, and I will praise your name.